The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards with another edition of the Armchair Traveler from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. And over the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the New York Times and the Washington Post. Now, before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles we're going to be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. Most of us, when preparing to travel, like to check the weather. We want to make sure that we take the right clothes for the climate we're going to be visiting. Well, travel writer Sarah Kahn thought she knew what to expect when she headed for Zanzibar. But, as the title of her article suggests, Zanzibar in the Rain, her journey turned out to be soggy and wet. And her story, found in the January 22, 2020 issue of the New York Times, and the subhead reads, "A soggy week on the Tanzanian archipelago leads to a mysterious curio shop, a taste of Zanzibar pizza, and conversations with locals and a bit of spice lore. If my circumstances had not been so dire, or rather, if my circumstances had been drier, I might never have found myself at the Zanzibar curio shop. At first glance, the store did little to distinguish itself from other trinket purveyors besieging the tangled lanes of Stonetown, the historic quarter on the coast of Unguja, Zanzibar's main island. Hakuna Matata t-shirts obscured the facade, and tourists browsed souvenirs. In any other city, I'd breeze past, but, sodden from the fury of a downpour, feigning an interest in refrigerator magnets seemed a small price to pay for shelter. If you want the real history of Zanzibar, you have to come upstairs," said Murtaza Abakarali, who, with his brother, runs the store their father opened in 1968. "And so I followed him through a portal of Zanzibar of yore. Hand-carved wood and brass trunks teetered against one wall. Vintage cigarette ads from India and political posters from Tanzania formed a retro pistache on another. The ceiling was an inverted necropolis of time-worn lanterns and teapots suspended from the rafters. Cameras and African tribal bust were jumbled in some nooks. Others were orderly archives of domestic ephemera, a wall of grandfather clocks, a cluster of rusting keys likely belonging to earlier iterations of the brass-studded doors I'd been compulsively Instagramming all over Stonetown. I flipped through bundles of black-and-white Indian matrimonial headshots, the subjects, bouffants, curlicues of eyeliner, and flared pants suggesting a 1960s provenance. In one room, I paused before a glass cabinet of daggers, glinting with bejeweled and mother-of-pearl hilts. You have to be careful when writing about a place like Zanzibar, not to reduce it to a series of prosaic meditations on brilliantly sunny skies, blindingly white beaches, and beguilingly azure waters. Even the British explorer, Sir Richard Francis Burton, wasn't immune. Truly, prepossessing was our first view of the then mysterious island of Zanzibar, he wrote in Zanzibar City, Island and Coast in 1872. The sea of purest sapphire, under a blaze of sunshine which touched every object with a dull burnish of gold. To prevent such exaltations from finding their way into my own notebook, Zanzibar made sure I encountered nothing of the sort. I'd landed on the first day of a delayed rainy season. While I'd been ready for showers, nothing short of packing an ark could have prepared me for the apocalyptic tempests that descended with my flight. Swimming in sapphire seas might have been out of the question, but I hadn't considered swimming down streets that had been transformed into gushing canals. These were not silvery, romantic mists slinking through latticed rooftops. This was a miasma of damp and despair. Undeterred, I brandished my umbrella like a shield and waded through the waterlogged streets of Stonetown. While I certainly wouldn't have minded them, beaches and sunshine weren't where it had lured me anyhow. As someone who's lived in the Middle East, India, and Africa, I've long been curious about the confluence of the three cultures on an archipelago that could, on a map, be mistaken for ink splotches in the Indian Ocean just off the coast of Tanzania. The Swahili language spoken here is a composite of Bantu and Arabic, which with rather tributes to Persian, Portuguese, English, and Hindi. The architectural dialect is also complex, a dulcet dialogue between African, Arab, Indian, and European influences. The briny air gnawing patterns into the walls, the serpentine lanes shaded by filigreed balconies, and the ornately carved teak doors all lend Stone Town a dreamlike beauty that even sheets of rain can't obscure. The culturally layered cuisine I would sample and the mishmash of trinkets I browsed at Zanzibar Curio Shop, scavenged from estate sales, told me more about Zanzibar than a sun-drenched beach ever could. Next section is titled Where a Far-Flung Corners Converge. Well, Zanzibar is not just one thing, Arab, Indian, Persian, or Bantu. It's what they call Swahili, the fashion designer Farouk Abdallah said. With his dark glasses, embroidered keffiyeh hat, and a playful tugging at his lips, as he doles out sharp one-liners, Mr. Abella is hard to miss. But if you want to be certain to catch him, your best bet is dropping by the Emerson Urmutsi Hotel, an elegant 19th-century mansion once owned by a wealthy advisor to a sultan. Mr. Abdallah designed the hotel's jewel box interiors and holds court most mornings on a divan in its lobby. It's very difficult for people to place Zanzibar. Is it the Orient? Is it African? What is it? He paused. I think that's what makes it interesting. You can trace the cultures that mingled in Zanzibar through Mr. Abdallah's lineage. He's a native of Zanzibari, of Kumaran, Indian, and Arab descent, who spent much of his life in England and before returning to Stone Town 16 years ago. Zanzibar is the most beautiful and peaceful place in the world, he declared. We are all one. I can't go against Arabs because I have a little blood of that. I can't go against Indians because there's a little blood of that. You can't pick a fight with someone because of their ethnicity or because of their faith. It's a noble sentiment, but one that downplays Zanzibar's complex and often tragic history. Straddling strategic coordinates for ancient trade routes, Zanzibar was, for centuries, where far-flung corners of the world converged. The region was settled by Bantus from mainland Africa, then Persians, Portuguese, and Arabs, each wave leaving indelible influences on the language, dress, food, and religion. Today, Zanzibar's population is almost entirely Muslim. For two centuries, it was part of the Sultanate of Oman. For a brief period in the 1880s, the Omani capital was moved from Muscat to Stone Town. The archipelago became immensely wealthy from the brutal slave trade to both Europe and Asia, and was also a hub for ivory and spices. Europe's scramble for Africa saw Zanzibar become a British protectorate in 1890, then finally a violent 1964 revolution led to Zanzibar's union with Tanganyika, now known as Tanzania. Next section is titled Of Pepper and Cinnamon. Spices remain one of Zanzibar's calling cards, though things have changed quite a bit over the centuries. Back in the day, pepper had as much value as cocaine today, said Raphael Fleury, a Swiss lawyer who is now the director of the Spice Cooperative 1001 Organic in Stone Town. These days, Zanzibar's purported spice farms tend to be mainly for show, staging tours and performances geared toward visitors. In fact, many of the spices on sale in Zanzibar's markets are imported. Seeking a less commercial outing, I joined Mr. Fleury and Ethan Frisch, a New York-based entrepreneur whose company, Burlap and Barrel, imports spices directly from farmers around the world. Mr. Frisch was in Zanzibar on a sourcing trip, and on a rare morning when the sun pried its way out of the clouds and held the raindrops at bay, I tagged along as they met with farmers growing nutmeg, cinnamon, and black pepper. Spices have been ignored in the global food revolution, Mr. Frisch said. There are heirloom tomatoes, single-origin coffee. I'm trying to find heirloom spices. Or Burlap and Barrel procures everything from Icelandic kelp flakes to blue turmeric from Vietnam. Zanzibar had been Mr. Frisch's first scouting trip in 2016. It's a place ignored by the global commodity trade, but with a significant history of spice trade, he said. A culinary adventure. But what really drew me to Stonetown and what kept beckoning me out into the spongy air and sleepy off-season streets was the food. The island's long relationship with spices and the cultures that converged in pursuit of them have concocted a singular and delicious culinary tableau. In Zanzibar, fusion is a creed, not a craze. A mixture of culture rather than food is how Mr. Abdullah described the urujo to me. The stew, popularly known as Zanzibar mix, is hearty, rainy day food, best slurped, not eaten. It's all the cultures of Zanzibar in a little bowl, he noted. When I tried for myself, it was as though my taste buds were circumnavigating the globe. A few chunks of mishaki, or East African grilled meat, sliced off a skewer, draped with Indian-inspired fried bahijas, local cassava strips, and chunks of potatoes, originally introduced to the region from the Americas by Europeans, then layered with generous dollops of coconut chutney and fiery chili sauce and doused in a sour mango broth. That definitely is a cosmopolitan recipe, isn't it? The dumplings yielded deferentially to my fork, the soup was bright and citrusy, and each sloppy spoonful came laden with visions of sunny afternoons and balmy weather that weren't written in my destiny. On most days, the storms were relentless, so it was with relief to escape the worst of the downpours with the promise of a meal. During one cloudburst, I ducked into Masha Allah, a no-frills cafeteria-style restaurant, to bide my time over a plate of beef masala. During another, I watched sheets of rain lash the beach from the cosseting confines of the Serena Hotel, where I tucked into a kukupaka, a flavorful chicken coconut stew popular along the Swahili coast in Kenya and Tanzania. From a woman hunched in a sheltered nook off the side of the road, I picked up a pillowy disc of makate wa ufata, that sesame bread baked over coals, and ripped off chewy, perfectly charred chunks to nibble on a baraza, a shaded bench that's a fixture outside traditional Swahili houses. One sultry evening, I climbed a series of dizzying staircases of Iscarian proportions onto the rooftop of the Emerson Spice Hotel, where course after course of traditional Zanzibari dishes with contemporary twist, tuna timbale, roast shelly, that's breadfruit, chatsa michkatsa, which is oyster wrapped in spinach leaves, and coconut-crusted kingfish, all served with a soothing staccato of rainfall against the roof, and the call to prayer echoing from the dozens of surrounding mosques. Next, we'd look for Zanzibar pizza. And yet the dish that inspired my Epicurean exploits was in danger of eluding me. The curiously named Zanzibar pizza, a snack I'd never tasted and yet had somehow developed an unlikely sort of nostalgia for, now I just needed a long enough respite from the elements to find it. You can smell Stonetown's main culinary destination before you see it. The nightly open-air food market at the sea-facing Borodani Gardens. It's usually a festive affair, but on my first visit, the weather put a literal damper on the market and washed the vendors out. I returned to satisfy my craving on another drizzly evening, bypassing stalls, cranking out sugarcane juice and urujo to make a beeline for a row of pizza hawkers with names like Mr. Delicious and Mr. Big Banana, before the range triumphed again. I watched entranced as a jovial chef, I'd gone with Mr. Nutella, rolled out a mound of greasy dough, slick with oil and likely more than a few dashes of perspiration and rainwater. Against that gleaming canvas, he scattered minced beef, sprinkled a chiffonade of onions, tomatoes, and green peppers, dressed it all with salt, mayonnaise, cheese, and acar, a spicy condiment. Then cracked an egg on top of it before slapping it on a griddle until it attained that optimal level of chewy, crispy communion. Think of it as an adopted sibling of Italian pizza. The same last name, but a completely different genetic makeup. The concoction was more crepe than pizza, but the result tasted just as delicious as its laundry list of components might pretend. Well, I'd barely finished my last bite when I felt the unmistakable splat, first on my shoulder, then on my cheek, then on my head. Then everywhere, all at once. The rains were back without warning, though at this point I knew better than to expect one. I followed other diners to congregate under a feeble tent until it passed, but what was the point? Instead, I splashed my way out to the sticky night, soggy, but satisfied. So some fun in Zanzibar for today's journey. What do you think? Well, let's move on. Our next stop is Iquitos, Peru, courtesy of travel writer Emily Gillespie, who instead of flying took a slow cruise down the Amazon on a cargo ship to reach her destination. And her article's from the October 4th, 2019 issue of the Washington Post. As the boat glided down the Amazon River, I swung from a hammock and watched the seemingly endless jungle pass by. I was entranced. I'd never seen so many shades of green in one place. I had come to witness the Amazon rainforest firsthand, and it was already putting on an amazing show. Commanding 2.3 million square miles, the rainforest is one of the most biologically diverse places on the planet, home to millions of species of plants, animals, and insects, many of which have yet to be identified by scientists. Thanks in part to the rubber boom of the late 1800s, it's accessible to visitors through a handful of port towns that dot the edges of a few of the thousands of rivers that weave through the jungle. One of the best of those towns for basing a visit to the Amazon is Iquitos, Peru, which, at more than 400,000 people, is actually a city. Aside from one highway that runs between it and a smaller nearby port town, there are no roads connecting Iquitos to the outside world. The only way into and out of the city is by plane or boat. While most people opt for the under 2-hour flight from Lima or a day-long speedboat ride from a town reachable by car, I decided on a more uncommon approach to Iquitos, a 3-day cruise via cargo ship. I learned that cargo ships were an Amazon basin transportation option from a German couple I met while traveling in South America with my husband. It sounded so romantic. We'd find a boat with room for us and spend a few days drifting along two tributary rivers before meeting up with the world-famous Amazon River. Flanked by wild jungle, I would take in the first sights and sounds at a slow, relaxed pace. Thankfully, we're flexible travelers and we're on a leisurely schedule because you can't book these trips in advance and schedules are uncertain. Just traveling from the northwestern city of Trujillo, where we'd enjoy some beach time, to Yurimagua, the Peruvian river town or river port town from which the cargo ships depart, required a 20-plus-hour bus ride followed by a 2-hour ride in a colectivo, essentially a shared taxi. Most travelers get to Yurimagua via the north-central town of Tarapoto. Well, when my husband and I arrived at Yurimagua, we went straight to the central market to buy supplies for the crews, hammocks, and mosquito nets to drape over them. Bowls for our meals aboard the ship, also some bottled water and snacks should we need food for a while. Well, then we headed for the port, or so we thought. Turns out that we were at the wrong one. No cargo ships were leaving from it. When we reached the correct port in the northeast corner of the town with our moto taxi driver called Inapu, we saw a flurry of activity. The small dock, which could more accurately be described as a slab of flat shoreline that abuts the river, had enough space for a handful of boats. Using slats of wood as ramps from the muddy ground, men carried armfuls of watermelons, bags of rice, furniture, electronics, and live animals onto the two docked cargo ships. After talking to a man in an authoritative orange vest, I discovered that only one boat, the Kiara 1, would let us aboard. The Eduardo 8, docked next door, had filled two entire decks with live chickens and wasn't taking on any human passengers. In between the activity, we slipped onto the Kiara 1 and strung our hammocks between rusty holes in the ceiling of the open-air deck at the stern of the boat. This would be our sleeping area for the journey. Once we got situated, we waited. While cargo boats in the area regularly allow travelers passage for a fee, we paid the equivalent of about $30 apiece, which included meals. The cargo is the priority, and the boat would only leave once the 200-foot-long ship was full. That, however, was a difficult thing to determine. Asking three crew members about the departure time elicited three different responses, which did nothing to ease my fears of being left behind. I had been warned that it could take a few days to embark, so this really only became a problem when we wanted to leave the ship to get lunch or dinner. Meals were covered only when we were moving. I decided the best way to determine whether we had enough time to leave was to look at the cargo. If there was still a good amount of product to unload from a truck onto the ship, it felt safe to leave the ship for a few hours. To pass the time, I chatted with our hammock mates. Of the roughly 50 passengers, about 10 were international travelers like us, and the rest were locals. Through my conversational Spanish, I learned that some of the locals were related to the crew, and others were just going between towns after doing business or visiting family. Simply sitting on the docked boat was surprisingly enjoyable. At one point, a pod of dolphins splashed around our ship for a few hours. Some were the pink dolphins that are famous in the Amazon, which prompted awes from the non-Peruvians. We were also thoroughly entertained by the nearby chicken boat. One by one, several chickens, presumably bound for the dinner table, jumped overboard. They bobbed away with the current of the river, prompting both cheers for the birds that were making a bid for freedom and a debate about whether chickens could swim. By the time the boat finally left, we'd spent a total of 36 hours, including two full nights, on the docked ship. But once we got going, any frustration born from delay dissipated. The gentle warm breeze and the sights and sounds of the Amazon made for a tranquil experience. Over the low rumble of the ship's engine, I heard a choir of birds chirping and the sound of crickets screeching. Trees thick with vines were so dense that there was no way to see much farther than the water's edge. Every so often, the green of the forest was broken up by stilted thatched houses. As the boat slowly passed, I captured glimpses into the lives of those who called the Amazon home. A young woman washing clothes, boys playing soccer in a field, young men loading bananas onto a long wooden boat. The rivers we traveled are a milky brown color that I later learned comes from sediment. While that made the waters appear dirty, various pieces of floating garbage added to the impression. It was painful to see some of the crew members throw their trash into the water. At one point, I watched as a man on our boat struggled to resecure a tarp draped over some cargo, only to toss the tarp overboard a few minutes later, seemingly out of frustration. The accommodations, which included the option of a few cabins, though everyone chose hammock space given the heat, were about what you'd expect from a cargo ship. Water pooled in many parts of the rusty deck, and spiders came out in droves at night. At one point, I spotted a fat, several-inch-thick, long black beetle that sent me running. A Peruvian girl, who couldn't have been more than 5, picked it up, moved it away from me without flinching, leaving me feeling as though we'd swapped our child-adult roles. The bathrooms were awful. The floor was constantly covered with about an inch of standing water. The toilet had no seat and didn't flush, so waste had to be washed down with a bucket and seemingly flowed into the river. A pipe hanging from the ceiling in the middle of the room was used to fill the bucket. It also doubled as a shower, which I couldn't bring myself to use. Thankfully, I thought to pack baby wipes, which I used every day. Even so, I was grimy. The meals were tastier than I expected, though a bit odd and lacking in variety. One lunch consisted of chicken, rice, and potatoes, while another was essentially the same ingredients, but in soup form. For dinner, we were served a sweet cinnamon-flavored milky soup with bits of rice floating in it. If you closed your eyes and imagined a mug instead of a bowl, it would have made a decent after-dinner by the fire beverage. For breakfast, we were served chicken soup one morning and the milk soup another. Between watching the scenery go by and chatting with other passengers, I also filled the days living in my hammock reading. Each night on board, the international passengers crowded around a small headlamp and played various games. I had packed a small bottle of rum, which got passed around, and that, along with some translation-induced hilarity, had us laughing until the night. Well, by the end of the second day, our boats reached Nata, the small town that connects to Iquitos by road. Here, a lot of locals got off. A bus to Iquitos would only take about 2 hours rather than the 8 hours left to go via boat. Having gone 4 days without showering, the idea of getting to my destination more quickly was pretty appealing, but after buying some beer and snacks, all the international travelers got back on the boat and gathered on the topmost deck above the wheelhouse. We just weren't done with the journey. Surrounded by strangers turned friends, I watched as the blue sky faded to oranges and pinks that deepened as the sun set. A feeling of contentment washed over me. I had grown to appreciate how time seemed to move differently on the boat. The smallest moments and simplest observations were enjoyed in full because we had nowhere else to be and nothing else competing for our attention. Early the next morning, we drifted into the port at Iquitos. Groggy, but excited to have finally made it, we exchanged contact information, and went our separate ways. Overall, the trip was immensely satisfying. The slow pace allowed me to really get to know my neighbors. Everyone on the KR-1 came from different walks of life, but on the ship, we were all equal. We were confined to the same space, ate the same meals at the same time, and suffered through the same mosquito-filled, air-conditionerless heat together. It was a humbling reminder that we're all the same, no matter or no better or worse than anybody else in this world. Well, choosing to take this journey is like choosing to handwrite a letter. Modern technology has made it easier and quicker to type an email, but putting pen to paper forces your brain to slow down, make ideas flow differently. It's more therapeutic and, in my opinion, more meaningful. Well, with traveling, we've made it easier to reach far-flung places, but I'm starting to wonder if we lose something when we jet around from place to place. Sometimes I think the slow boat is exactly what we need. Again, the article written by Emily Gillespie, and she is a writer based in Portland, Oregon, and you can find her online at emilygillespie.com. Gillespie is spelled G-I-L-L-E-S-P-I-E, emilygillespie.com. She's also on Twitter at Emily Gillespie. And in case you're asking some thoughts about, taking a cargo ship from Yurimaguas to Iquitos, well, here's some tips. Cargo ships to Iquitos leave Yurimaguas year-round and can be reached via the city of Tarapoto. That's about 600 miles northeast of Lima, Peru. A bus from Lima to Tarapoto should take about 24 hours and cost about $30. A flight should take about an hour and 15 minutes and cost around $150. From Tarapoto, you can take a colectivo, and that is a shared taxi to Yurimaguas, which should take about 2 hours and cost about $5. In Yurimaguas, take a moto taxi to the Yanapu-Yurimaguas port terminal in the northeast corner of the city. Don't do that like they did and go to the opposite end. Once you arrive at the dock, ask around for which cargo ships are accepting passengers, and then you pay the captain for your passage and onboard meals, somewhere around $30. Now, if you haven't already bought a hammock and food, you can take a moto taxi to the central market before heading to the port. Cargo ships don't adhere to a schedule, leaving only when they are full, so departure could take a few days, as in the case of our article, it took 4 days. And to return to Lima, flights from Iquitos leave daily, and they cost about $65. So you can get out of town kind of quick, if you see what I'm saying. So lots of fun down there in Yurimaguas and Peru and getting to see the Amazon firsthand. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Armchair Traveler. Hope you've enjoyed your journey and that you'll join us next time. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, reminding you the content of our program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. Comments and questions may be directed to 919-832-5138. Bye-bye.